Sitting in a living room, sitting on the porch. It's your words, gonna light that torch. Tell it in a city park, tell it in a bar, tell it in the backseat of your grandma's car. No tales too pure, our failures lure. The poor house sure wants to hear what's bubbling in your brain.
Welcome to the final episode of Tales from the Poorhouse for this year. We've got a couple of themes going on. When the bird blackened the sky, and also, that's not self-esteem. We gave our readers a prompt. They worked for an hour and a half, and these are the stories they came up with. Hope you enjoy it. Anthony Rosso is glad Casey PFAB isn't here. When Casey PFAB is in the room, Anthony is very intimidated by his force. Anthony.
Yeah, it's a bitch when the biography gets more laughs than the story. This is titled The Rug. I stared down at the clogged razor blade. It had four blades, four neat rows of metallic shine, except for the small sprout of coarse hair stuck between them. Thick, gnarly strands of embarrassment. I looked in the mirror. I looked back at the razor. Honey, can I get some help, please? I asked. With what? I'm trying to find the car keys, she replied. Every time I looked at the razor, it seemed to get smaller. But that tuft, that bestial force of tuft just kept on growing. I need help shaving my back. The last syllable released with a prepubescent squeak. But puberty, oh baby, did I know about puberty. At 11, the seed had already been planted. Each pore across my virgin back had already been spoiled. I blame my mother, not my father. No, that would have been an easy out. It was that matronly soul who overcooked my eggs most mornings that was to blame. Well, not directly. But those men on her side of the family, oh Lord, the monkeys they carried on their backs were infamous. When they wore cotton shirts, the long strands of hair would find their way through the small windows of fabric like the heads of children through the windows of school buses. When I hit 12, I was already in my second season of harvest. I would take my single blade disposable Bic razor with orange handle, and I would hack and cleave my way through generations of hereditary horror. Gosh, sweetie, my mom would say, it looks just like a big black bird came and crashed right into your back. Feathers all spread, every which way but right. I held the now blackened razor in front of me, my hand shaking from the adrenaline and spite. I know, Mom, I know. And so the legend has gone on for 23 years. And every year, though not on the same day, not even the same month, my day of reckoning, my day of face-to-back reconciliation must come. And when it does, I am never fully prepared. I do train, exercises that enable me to reach places behind me that most people cannot reach. Underneath the shoulder blade, I remember it like it was yesterday, that spring day of my sophomore year in high school, the same year I told my mom that I was going to sue. Call them all, I said, every lawyer in the book. I will have my day in court. I will sue for hereditary injustice. But my mom said no. Today is that day. That day when the beast comes out of its hole and greets me again with terror and shame. That day when the worlds don't align and the stars fall out of the sky. That day when the sun shines bright. That day when the thermometer boils, that day when my wife wakes me up and says, honey, let's go to the beach today. Oh God, the words, the torment they cause. It's no worse than the devil himself reaching that red veiny arm down my throat and grabbing my vertebrae and shaking my soul, spirit, and pride out of every orifice. So here, even surrounded by boxes of razor blades, the best creams, gels, and lubricants money can buy, the love of a wife, the patience, the dedication, the support. These things aid my fight, but aid is all they must do. This is my war, and fight I must. So here today I stand, waiting, hoping something or anything will release me from this moral vice grip. But no, not today. Not even if the bird blackens the sky will I be free of this curse. For if not today, surely tomorrow the sun and heat will rise again, and I must face the sand.
Next up tonight, we have Ben Wheeler, who was once offered sex by a guy who wanted help painting his house. Ben is very excited to adopt a cat this fall. Ben.
I think maybe that the true measure of bravery is the willingness to jump into something without knowing what's at the bottom. I don't tell stories. And don't give me any of that meta crap about the fact that I'm telling a story right now. I've always thought that people who are too forthcoming in sharing the details of their own boring lives are like some kid at the pool, dropping his shorts, wiggling his hips so what he's got swings, saying, "Woohoo! How's this for an extended metaphor?" The point is, that's not self-esteem. Having self-esteem is knowing when to shut it and realize that most of the pages that fill your life would be utterly boring to anyone else. For the most part, like everyone's, my life has been nothing special. Why are you so sad? Shut up, kid, I'm narrating. But you said there was a story, and I'll get to it. Haven't you kids ever heard of exposition? If I tell the story without getting up to the point, it'll be like, are you going to make another wiener metaphor? You're too young to know about metaphor. I'm 8. Do you want a story or not? Fine. Then shut up. You wouldn't complain if a machine gave you a blue gumball instead of a green one. You still get a gumball. No, put your hand down. I'm only telling you this because you asked. I don't know how you found out about it. I was just minding my own business, doing my job. I worked security at a big city bank downtown. Supervillains talked about knocking us over all the time, but no one ever did. They had easier marks than us. So I did my job, protected the money, and for 22 years everything was peaceful. Then one day the malevolent maestro stormed into the bank with his army of treble clefs, a minor chord cocked in each hand, yelling, "Hand over the money or I'll make everyone mezzo piano." Well, people just lost their minds. Everyone dropped to the floor. Men pulled off their watches and waved them over their heads like flags of surrender. Women slipped rings free from their fingers. But I had my training. I ducked behind the teller's desk and checked the load on my service revolver. This was back when they still allowed us to have guns. I popped out of cover and boom, dropped two of the treble clefs where they stood. They fell to the floor and shattered into sharps and quarter rests. The malevolent maestro raised his conductor's baton, and two of the remaining clefs transformed into insane 30-second notes and flew at my head. I ducked just in time, and they lodged like throwing knives in the wall behind me. I looked over the desk and now saw that the maestro had taken a hostage, a slender woman with red hair and high boots. He held a minor chord to her temple. "Throw down the gun, or I'll turn her into a diminished third," he said. Then, with a smile, he said, "Sustained." And that was when I understood that the maestro had somehow gone insane. There were many theories of his origin, but the most common was that he had been a music graduate student. Driven mad by a woman who would not love him, he threw himself into levels of musical theory unplumbed by even our most masterful composers. And legend is that he had at last found what he'd been seeking, a melody so achingly lovely that anyone who heard it would have to fall in love with him. When does Captain Awesome get here? You're killing me, kid. Captain Awesome will get here 3 sentences from now. Does this one count? No. Anyway, that level of musical knowledge was unnatural. That's one. It drove him mad, which was the start of his life of crime. Two. Maybe the woman he took as a hostage was his unrequited love. Three. That's it. I pointed my gun squarely at the maestro, and that was when, crashing through the glass window at the front of the bank instead of using the door like the showy jerk that he is, Captain Awesome showed up. That was too many teasing clauses, but yay, Captain Awesome. "Your symphony of terror," won't get another movement, said Captain Awesome. This is just the overture, Captain Awesome, the maestro said. He gripped the woman tighter, bearing down on the trigger of the minor chord. The woman squeezed her eyes shut. Even the most skilled cellist, said Captain Awesome, breaks a string from time to time. Aha, said the maestro. But the most skilled player can... I shot the maestro in the head. The recoil propagated down my arms, settling into my shoulders, making my jaw buzz. The maestro dropped the minor chord, and as he fell, fermatas and arpeggios leaked out of the neat hole in his forehead until the last coda drained out of him. You shot him? You wanted a story. You're a bad man. How could you? The maestro was crazy, trying something unnatural to get something that wasn't his. That ain't self-esteem either. You can't just make someone love you, and he wasn't going to stop. Captain Awesome should have thrown you in jail. That Captain Awesome you love so much couldn't throw a blind hamster baby in jail. He looked from me to my leveled smoking gun barrel, back to me, and back again. Citizen, he said, and scrambled away, colliding against the side of a building before he finally flew away. This is stupid, and I hope you die. The kid finally got off my porch and took off down the street, leaving me here to narrate my own boring life to myself, thinking about what the purpose of life was. I am the lilac in love Gruyere cheese, said some crazy guy down the street for no apparent reason. And I guess if you're going to live by words, those are as good as any other.
Next up, we have Nick Reller. He wrote his entire story in cursive. The Z's and Y's are indistinguishable from each other. Nick.
This story is called The Baby Shower. Now here's one for Garrison Keeler, he says, holding the scrap of paper to the yellow light of his matador lamp, which is unnecessary because he's already memorized what he's written. It's just the sort of poem that would be read on the radio. I am the lilac by Dade Dern. She won't turn to look at him. She's at the kitchen table dropping $2 chocolate bars in gift bags for a baby shower. He holds the paper back up to the light. My fingers burst with purple and white. I'm done, Dade. I'm so over this. Well, how do you think I feel? He's been ready to discuss this for a long time. Her chair moans across the linoleum. She clips a leash on Dakota and flings open the screen door. Hey, he says. He knocks his glass pipe off the arm of the couch, limps out onto the front porch, and calls after her. What do you think you're doing? I'm walking Dakota. Bullcrap. People take dogs for walks, Dade. Her bare shoulders are quivering. My God, are you that lazy? You don't know what walking a dog is? She is jerked back as Dakota lunges at a child, reclaiming a tricycle from a shrinking snow patch in the front yard. Give me that leash. She opens the luminous passenger door and stares at him as Dakota hops in. I know you won't. She slams the door and walks around to the driver's side. I know you won't, Marnie. The Lumina clears its throat and jolts into the cul-de-sac, scaring several underdressed children up onto the curb. He stumbles on the porch steps and hits his mouth on the driveway. It is Thursday. On Friday, his lip is big enough to cover the patch of hair under his mouth. He receives a letter from Garrison Keeler, wet from children shoving snow in his mailbox. Day Dern, I do not write to you because your poems impress me. In fact, they anger me, and not in the way a poet hopes to anger his audience. Mr. Dern, you live in a self-satisfied vacuum. You have nothing to say, and yet you insist on speaking. Think about that before you tear up this letter and indulge yourself in another. He tears the letter into He takes his pipe from the top of the refrigerator and sticks 28 cartoon classics into the DVD player for some background noise. Once he starts feeling smart, he begins to write on the back of a sheet of Dress Barn coupons. He's writing from the perspective of the alligator snapping turtle who bit his old knee off when he worked at the reptile zoo. He squints his eyes, and the matador's light gets weak and leggy. And he pictures his own face staring down at him from the surface of a green pool. A muffled, warbly, above-water voice says, "Harley has been with us for 30 years now," as he drags along the cement bottom of the pool. What rage he feels when his tail is jerked. All right, this is getting good. A dog barks outside. His heart swells. The dog barks again. It is not Dakota. Dakota has a much prouder voice. He looks out the screen door, just in case. Three boys and a girl are surrounding a neurotic Springer Spaniel in his driveway. The tallest boy threatens the dog with a broken piece of vinyl siding from the house. When he returns to the poem, it makes no sense. He realizes that instead of getting smarter, he's just become more easily impressed. He grabs his hair. When he wakes up Saturday morning, there's a drawing on the coffee table of Garrison Keillor lying in a bed with the owner of the reptile zoo. Tears are streaming down Garrison Keillor's face. The matador lamp is sideways on the carpet, its outstretched arm broken off clean at the shoulder. Music from the menu screen of 28 Cartoon Classics has been playing all night. He has internalized it. He collects the Garrison Keillor letter. The signature is torn in half. He considers taping it together, but does not. By Sunday morning, there is a 20-gallon aquarium on top of the console television with $40 worth of live aquatic plants and a pale-faced, sideways-swimming betta fish inside. It was the sickest fish in Walmart, but it's already becoming more alert, like maybe its self-esteem is improving. Sometimes it even flares its gills. That's not self-esteem, it's vanity, but he doesn't hold it against the fish. He's happy for the fish. He spends the morning with the fish. It actually watches him through the glass. It's the smartest fish he's ever seen. At 2 p.m, two blondes with black roots unload a pregnant woman from a minivan in his driveway. They walk up and smile through the screen door, not showing the slightest concern about introducing themselves. Eventually, their smiles fade, and they finally say, "This is Marnie's house?" "This will be the place," he says. His lip makes his voice sound sloppy. "She's doing a baby shower today?" "You tell me." They turn their heads to look the neighborhood over. "Yes, she is," they say. "Well, okay then. She must be on her way." The pregnant woman reaches down to rub her calf. "This an inside party?" he says. "I assume so," says one of the blondes. "Okay then." He waves his arm toward the inside of the house and walks back to his chair next to the aquarium. The women walk through the screen door slowly, murmuring to each other. He overhears that Angel is on her way with a ham and Gruyere tray. La-dee-da. The fish gives a sort of be-nice look. "You need anything to drink?" he calls to the women in the kitchen. That's all I have.
That was our own Danny Purcell's version of the theme song for The Young and the Restless. Thanks, Danny. Next up, we have Maggie Ryan Sanford, who's a writer, a journalist, an amateur marine mammalogist living hopelessly far from the ocean. She also performs. Check her out at MaggieRyanSanford.com.
This is called Phone Call Home, February 13th, 1976. Hey, Mom, it's Sally. And no, I'm not calling because I need money, even though I know that's just exactly what Daddy is saying now, isn't it? God, as if the quote-unquote almighty dollar is more important than, like, clean water for orphans in Burma. Has Dad even ever heard of Burma? He probably, like, owns coal mines in Burma, but couldn't even be bothered to learn, for instance, that it's a matriarchal society. Isn't that just devastatingly beautiful? Isn't it, Daddy? God. I was just calling to give you one last freaking salutation before I head off to South America with Rainbow, which I don't even want to get into that about him, Mother, right now. What you find unpalatable about a person who, whilst engaged in a walkabout, which, by the way, no white man has ever attempted to date, if that person, at age 41, finds himself suddenly audienced to the voice of the Earth Spirit, who bestows upon him the chosen name of Rainbow, you don't just make that up, okay? Rainbow isn't the name you choose for yourself to impress people or something. Like, you have to be a real man. That has to really come from somewhere real, okay? I mean, how do you... Thy name is Rainbow, bestowed upon him. It's a G-damn blessing, Mother. It's a G-damn gift from God, and you of all people should know that, or what else the hell is the Catholic guilt good for, after all? What's the point of even being a freaking Colton? Redemption, Mother. That's what the rainbow stands for, isn't it? Rebirth and resurrection. And yes, you cannot say resurrection without saying erection. And I said it. Tell Daddy. I said it, and this is not at all the reason I called. God, I just don't know. I don't know why I do this to myself. Why, all I wanted to do was to call you up and tell you an honest-to-goodness, blessed be, glad tidings from the goddess herself, Mother, the Mother Goddess, Mother, if you're even listening at this point, if you haven't pulled the phone machine tape from the bowels of its robot and cast it into the fire of plenty. Okay, I said I wasn't going to let you do this to me today. I was calling in good faith that you would even get this far in the message between your tennis and your tea and the GD Country Club with the rest of the upper crust. And you said, you can tell that to Daddy. I'm still with Rainbow. Tell him that. And we're using birth control pills. Because no, Mother, it is not God's quote-unquote will that the Colton breed should live on. Sorry to disappoint you, Mother. But I am not calling to tell you that I hold within my room the next Jesus baby of the aristocracy. No, you have no heir, and yes, I am in love with Rainbow, and we're mates for life, part of this great universal family that continues to devour all the rot and hate and putrescence of the universe, just like termites, Mother. Just like G-damn termites, chewing away at the sorry paper castle you and Daddy built yourself on a mountain of shame. No. Okay. I said I'd have the Buddha in my heart and the flower within the lotus. And no, that's not a cult thing, Mother. It's a G-damn Buddhist prayer. I called to say that I heard about Salminio, and I know how much he meant to you, how much he meant to all of us at some point. I called to say I remember watching that stupid old film with you, whatever it was called, The good old boys, or the days we had, or whatever the hell, with that guy who played Gilligan. My God, that man has an ass like an ironing board. Anyway, I called to say, I'm sorry you lost one of the good ones. We lost one of the good ones. I'm calling to say there was such a thing as a good war, even though the United States government has forgotten. And anyway, I'm going to South America, so don't try to call, but you can sense me if you need to tell me something. Just tell Sal, and I'm sure he'll pass it along. Oh, and happy Valentine's Day. Talk to you later.
Christopher T. McCarthy hails from Coon Rapids, Minnesota, and misses the feel of shag carpet under his naked toes, and hopes for a future where Connor Malloy is communist ruler of the United States. Christopher.
A super short moment in the life of a marriage. He wrote it on the wall above the stove in apricot orange paint. That's not self-esteem, that's society. What's that supposed to mean? Jenny asked, dipping her brush for more paint. I don't know, Eric said, shrugging. I think it's something from a kink song. Jenny lets out a low exhale of breath, murmuring, God, you writers. Since they married 2 years ago, Eric had heard that phrase many times. He heard it every time Jenny woke to the clacking of his keyboard at 4 a.m. God, you writers. Or when he tried to convince her of the genius of Ginsberg or Faulkner. God, you writers. Or when he read her one of his awful poems about a dead cat or a moldy washcloth. God, you writers. Or when he failed to repair some fixture in their apartment and had to call his father to come over. God, you writers. Painting over the words, that's not self-esteem, that's society, Eric said. How's your patient doing? What's his name again? The one who swallowed the pillowcase? He's doing fine, Jenny said shortly, and his name is Benjamin. Like you really care. She said it in a way that was hard for Eric to determine whether she was serious or not. The truth was that he really did care about Jenny's work at the mental health facility, but not in a way she appreciated. He enjoyed the stories of the wild and crazy people. The ones who threw their feces at the orderlies and called themselves Jack the Ripper or Cleopatra Reborn. Eric would sit in rapt attention as Jenny told of a patient who had managed to smuggle a spork up his rectum. Or jump from a cell window screaming, I am the lilac! It wasn't a problem until Eric started incorporating the patient's stories into his work. His last collection of short stories was aptly named Tales from the Madhouse. After reading it, Jenny gave him a long lecture. You know, these are real human beings, she said. Their suffering is real. It ended with Eric swearing he'd never do it again. Gazing at the back of his wife's head, Eric wondered if she thought of him as just another crazy person who smeared feces on the wall.
All right.
That's all the time we have for stories this year. Thanks so much to the English Department at Minnesota State Mankato. Thanks to KMSU. Big thanks to our producer, Seth Wells. I'm Jeff Herbach. Hope you have a great summer.
Sitting in a living room, sitting on the porch. It's your words, gonna light that torch. Tell it in a city park, tell it in a bar. Tell it in the backseat of your grandma's car. No tales too pure, our failures lure. The poorhouse sure wants to hear what's bubbling.